see the world with a whole new perspective. Join us and experience the unexplained on The Paranormal View.
And welcome, everybody, to The Paranormal View right here on the ParaX Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for taking the time to drop by and be with us tonight. We appreciate each and every one of you. And for those listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you also. If you are listening from somewhere else other than here in the chat room, feel free to come over to para-x.com and join the chat room. We have a brand new chat room, so you'll have to sign in and become a new member, you might say. It's very easy, and it's a very nice chat room. You'll really like it. My tongue will work here. If you want to do that, that's fine. If you're here in the chat room and you have questions tonight, you can private chat them too, either Henry Foister or Ceiling Cat, and we will get those questions answered for you. So, great show lined up for tonight, and I have one other person to get in, because right now I have with us Barbara Duncan.
I am here from sunny Northern California, where it's nice and cool and breezy, and thank God I'm not in the desert.
And I believe we now have Jeffrey Gould with us.
Hello. Yes. My computer is being kind of a jerk today.
Oh, well, that's okay. It's working now.
Yep. But I had rebooted it so that it wouldn't have that problem. And then I went in and Skype saying, you know, I think it's a good time to update. And then it just froze up. And I'm like, oh, God. And just as I was literally hit the, you know, restart, I suddenly hear, boop, 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 the Skype that you were trying to call. Like, oh, no, you know.
Yep. So, but anyway, we have a great guest lined up for tonight. But I just want to let everybody know that all of our people tonight is out on the West Coast except me. So they're having a great time out there. I'm having a great time here. Had a lovely day today, and we appreciate the weather and appreciate the people stopping by, and quite a few people here already. So we had a great time last week at Mid-South. The only problem was we could not get on to broadcast the show live because we had some problems with our network. We got it fixed. Everybody is on. It's going. And we great new chat room now. So come on over and check it out.
News is it's mobile. So if anybody who has a good
mobile connection,
that and cable that gives them cable on the go, that sort of thing, you can download it and go off the network. You can actually get into chat on your cell phone and your Android.
Is there an app or just go to
paraxradionetwork.com on your Google browser or whatever browser you're using.
Firefox.
And your chat will show up.
Because I went there when my computer was trying to, like, you rebel on me just now, and it gave me a guest name, and it's saying join. I'm like, well, where's sign in login?
You just type login.
Right.
I tried that, and it was like, no, I don't think so.
Up at the top of the page, you'll be able to sign in. There is at the top of the browser, there is a register for an account to become a permanent member.
Yep.
Well, I already am a permanent member, aren't
I? Well, because everything's new, you have to redo it because it's a different thing.
Not on that other chat room.
Yeah. Oh, because this isn't that anymore.
Nope. This is totally different. So
new and improved.
It is, I guess, made by Minute.
Yes.
Yep. Minute Chat. So it's a different thing.
It's not a Flash Player program, so it works on a lot more apps.
Yep, sure does. You don't have to have a Flash Player.
And so, welcome to Geek Talk.
Yes. So with that, though, because we do have a lot going on, Jeff, have you got stuff to introduce our guest?
I do. Tonight's guest is, unless I haven't heard otherwise, tonight's... Oh.
Now I got to turn the sound up. I got to have...
Here we go. It's actually playing on my phone. Tonight's guest is Marie D. Jones, a best-selling multiple-book author, a researcher, former radio show host, and public speaker. Marie's newest book, or at least the one was new last time, was Mind Wars, Who's Been Watching You from the Shadows, and currently residing in sunny northern San Diego County, California. It's probably now roasty northern southern San Diego. Marie is a highly regarded and popular speaker on science, metaphysics, consciousness, and the paranormal, and has appeared at major conferences and events. Also a screenwriter who's yet to still have neglected to write anything for me, a SAG actor or anything. Last we heard, Marie was developing Twilight Child, a science fiction feature film and a paranormal horror film titled 19 Hertz with Bruce Lucas production, from which I've not yet gotten a call. So last time she was on previously, Marie was also developing a paranormal-related television series for tweens. And there's so much bio that it would just take forever. So welcome back, Marie D. Jones.
Hello there. Not only that, but that's an old bio. Yes, I'm going to give you guys a new one.
Really?
and okay, so what kind of role do you want me to write for you? Like a comedic, dramatic, action? Do you like to do your own stunts?
I do my own stunts. I grew up in the
Do you? Okay.
Yeah.
Ah.
I grew up.
I would love to write something for you one day. Hopefully, I'll have that kind of power that I want this man. This is my lead man.
Well, I'm starring in a major motion picture next year based on the Mansfield killings.
Oh my gosh. Manson or Mansfield?
Mansfield, Ohio, as in we're going to actually be at the reformatory.
Oh, okay. Well, yes, you know what? The first chance I get, I mean, I would love to have the ability to you know, work with people I know and use people I know and say, okay, I'm handpicking my cast. And not quite yet. I'll get there.
At least you know your cat, you know, you just give him some fish and you go, no, he works for scale.
That's right. Union.
Well, tonight we're going to be talking with Marie about two of her newer books. One is called Super Volcanoes, and the other one is The Power of Archetypes. So we have lots and lots to talk about. I know doesn't matter whichever book you guys want to talk about first, Barbara.
Well, the reason I think... it's all over Amazon, too. Your book, Super Volcano, is making a resurgence in sales thanks to all the little tremors and other little disasters that they're having there.
At Yellowstone.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Mother Nature, for the uptick in book sales.
Best PR agent in the world.
Which is... go ahead, Barbara.
No, well... I wrote this book with my dad years ago, and then I wrote a revised edition last year. And, you know, my dad passed away a few years ago, so we never got a chance to do a second book. But what's so funny is you're so correct. Every time something happens at Yellowstone or Long Valley or, you know, anytime the word supervolcano is mentioned, there's an uptick in sales. And I don't know if I should feel good about that or guilty. But Yellowstone, it gets active and then it kind of quiets down for a while. And then, you know, maybe 6 months later, there's another swarm of earthquakes and then it quiets down. And it just makes us all really nervous.
Well, I lost count of how many this last swarm was. It was around 1,800, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pretty big. And, you know, I mean, that's very common for seismically active areas, or if there's a lot of magma moving underneath, you're going to get all kinds of activity. The problem we have with supervolcanoes is that the last one occurred about 25 to 28,000 years ago in New Zealand, And so we didn't have, you know, a written record of what everything that happened leading up to the super eruption. So for all we know, I mean, there is, you know, obviously we've learned quite a bit. We know that certain things do happen or have to happen, but we still don't know every single chain of events that will lead to it. So when there's a big microquake swarm like that, and then there's a few big ones like a 5 or 6, we're not sure if that's leading up to something really big, or, you know, it could be 500 years from now, that because there may be 6 or 7 more steps that have to occur after that microquake swarm in order for there to be a super eruption. So it's a little scary, but so far, and super volcanoes happen so rarely and so far in between because they need to have such a sizable buildup of magma in order for the, you know, there to be an eruption on that scale. But never say never.
Now, are we in kind of a, was it because the tectonic plates were still shifting around and the planet was new and these super volcanoes were more common in bygone era as they are now, as the planet starts to age a little bit more?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when Earth was being, the mountains were being formed and everything was in its early stage, you had so much more violent activity. And this was obviously before humans came along. And then even back to the most primitive of times when humans were on the Earth, it's still, you know, it's still pretty active. It does settle down, obviously, but we're still, I think we forget that we're still living on a planet that is still evolving, not so much so, but still, and that the ground beneath our feet in many places is sitting on, you know, moving magma, and these tectonic plates are still doing their thing. They're moving around, they're shifting. You know, we do get very large earthquakes that remind us of the fact that the ground beneath our feet isn't always stable. So yeah, we get those little reminders, but nothing like the early stages when the mountain ranges were being created and, you know, islands were being emerging from the water basically as the result of volcanic activity. I mean, to have been around during that time, we probably wouldn't have lasted a day.
Oh, yeah.
It was just such a violent, you know, we say violent, but obviously it's just nature doing its thing, just doing it pretty roughly.
So what is so significant, the volcano Toba?
The interesting, so there's the reason why my dad and I chose to write about Toba specifically is because it is one of the most significant supervolcanic eruptions in the fact that it had a distinct connection to the genetic evolution of humanity. And the reason why is about 75,000 years ago, Toba erupted on Sumatra, Indonesia. And at the time, there were not very many humans of any sort, you know, whether it was Homo sapien or Homo erectus or Neanderthalus or Floriensis, those little short guys, there were not a lot of individuals on the planet. So when it erupted, it created a volcanic winter, a nuclear winter is another term for it. A lot of, you know, a lot of life came to an end, and it created what's called a population bottleneck. So say we were about 100,000 individuals at the time. It cut down the population so much so that it's estimated there were maybe between 2 and 8,000 living humans of any, you know, of any type on the planet. So when you have that happen, the only way to regroup and survive is to breed like crazy. And that includes a lot of interbreeding. And so over the course of time, we got our numbers back up. Obviously, there's, you know, billions of humans today. And the theory, the Toba catastrophe theory states that we are all descendants of those, obviously, 2,000 to 8,000 survivors of Toba. And as they grew their numbers, as they bred and continued to breed, they moved out of Africa and into other parts of the world. So we're all kind of linked to Toba survivors. And there's been other population bottlenecks of other species all throughout, you know, recorded history. So it's not something that only happened once and only happened to humans. And the thing is that we face these same dangers, even though there are how many, 8-9 billion people supposedly by 2100. You know, if there's some kind of absolutely massive catastrophic event like an asteroid impact, it could create a very similar situation where our numbers go down so low that our distant future ancestors will be a genetic, from a very limited genetic line. So if you imagine a bottle filled with water, the water going out the neck of the bottle has to kind of narrow. You know, it's like going through a tunnel. It gets very narrow, and not all of it can go through at once. And it would be the same thing with our population. We would sort of narrow out quite a bit of our population. So in that sense, Toba was very unusual. It wasn't the biggest, you know, Yellowstone and Long Valley, they've been bigger, but it's because of the timing and the location. You know, we were emerging from Africa, moving into Asia, and that volcanic eruption was so big and it had such an impact that whoever was alive and did not take cover in a cave, you know, ended up dead. And that included other species of life, obviously, too. Mm-hmm.
So it's very similar to any cataclysm. The Ice Age, for example, would have done the exact same thing, where you have...
Yeah, it would have. Yeah. Right. The only difference is now we have so many people that there's bound to be a lot of survivors. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be really hard. You know, you always hear people say, oh, the end of the world. Well, come on. I don't know that it's possible, short of an absolute asteroid impact that literally blew the planet into pieces. A lot of the other catastrophes that people talk about would definitely wipe out a lot of humans, but not all of us. There are just way too many. And you know our politicians would be underground, so they would survive, unfortunately. But, you know, so when you're talking about things that happened 100,000 years ago, it really was catastrophic with a capital C, as opposed to today where it would be catastrophic. But we have so many, not just so many people, but we've learned survival techniques, and we've got, even though our infrastructure could be better, you know, there is some infrastructure there. Most of the countries of the world know how to respond to an emergency or a disaster, even large ones. Mm-hmm. So it would be really hard to see something like that on the same scale.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of that would come close would be a bio disaster, because we are such a mobile society. And if you had, like Ebola, which has already jumped different continents, that would be the only thing I could think of that would have the potential outside of an asteroid to decimate large populations.
I think it just depends on how quickly somebody could figure out how to quarantine enough, you know, to stop the spread, find patient zero, figure out a vaccine. But you're right. But again, like, I know this sounds really morbid, but my dad and I used to talk about how might the world end. We were both really fascinated with catastrophes. I think because he was a geophysicist, you know, there's just that sort of natural fascination with these, especially if it's nature doing it, you know, massive earthquakes and supervolcanoes and gamma ray bursts. And, you know, we would always kind of go through and think, well, no, there'd still be people left. And I remember one of the things that my dad told me that would be catastrophic on the scale of wiping out most of humanity would be methane bursts and the sort of snowball effect that they would have with climate change. So there are ways, definitely some kind of pandemic that is unstoppable, has, you know, it, where any time a vaccine is created, it's already morphed into something or mutated into something new. There are definitely things that could, you know, could wipe most of us off the map.
Well,
The super volcano, you're not just dealing with the volcano, though. You're dealing with the ash that is going to be around. So say if a super volcano, if Yellowstone or Long Valley in California super erupted, the northern, the northern hemisphere would be a dead zone. The southern hemisphere would still be operational until the ash began to come into, you know, with the jet stream or trade winds or whatever winds would blow that ash down south. And then they're going to start feeling the effects mainly on agriculture and with respiratory reactions, asthma, you know, respiratory diseases. But, you know, if an asteroid just nails us, it'll be quick.
At least it'll be quick.
But we can survive asteroid impacts,
yes,
as long as they're not that huge and they maybe hit, you know, Siberia. But then you have to deal with things like massive tidal waves and tectonic earthquakes and tectonic movements. And so we are so lucky when we wake up in the morning to get through a 24-hour period with nothing like that happening. If you know, you think about all the possibilities of what could happen.
Well, that asteroid,
pretty lucky.
Yeah, the asteroid that was a near miss, was it Tuesday? They just found it a couple of days before.
Are you serious? I didn't even hear about that.
Yeah, it's about the size
of a
football
field. How near miss are we talking?
Oh.
I mean, obviously it missed us, but how near miss is a near miss?
I think it was just shy of the lunar orbit range.
Oh, heavens. Yeah.
But small
enough. And, you know, that's where it would have maybe just taken out one city. I laugh, but I think you laugh out of just the you know, fear and anxiety it provokes. But I mean, there's asteroids and stuff coming at us, and we only may have a week, if not just a few days, of advance warning.
Although I hear now SETI has a GoFundMe project, which they're actually looking at laser mapping for the sky, and we're talking about a full 360 degree laser map.
Yeah, so they'll tell us which one is going to hit us.
Yeah.
I remember about 10 years ago, I remember reading in one of the science magazines that there was a program, the Department of Defense, NASA may have been in on it, where they were trying to develop some kind of laser or some kind of technique by which they could send a craft, you know, towards the asteroid and then zap it out of orbit. And that never happened. I guess it got defunded, or there just wasn't enough money, or they didn't think that it was critical enough. But I remember reading about that thinking, what was that movie? Was there a movie like that? Did they get the idea from the movie or vice versa?
Oh, Armageddon or some strange movie like that.
Yeah, or one of those. Yeah, I think
Deep
it was
Impact
Armageddon.
Or something.
Deep Impact and Armageddon pretty much came out almost the same time.
Yeah. Boy, what were we thinking about then? Jeez.
We were all thinking, why didn't we vote for Morgan Freeman for president?
No kidding. But, I mean, we live with the threats of these catastrophic events daily. You have to kind of put it out of your mind and go about your daily business, or it will drive you nuts.
Right.
Now, what are you going to do?
we know about Yellowstone, but you was talking about, Long Valley in California.
Long Valley.
Where is that located?
Well, it's kind of near Mammoth Lake. You know where Mammoth is? It's sort of in the central California area.
Hmm.
And the reason why it's even more frightening than Yellowstone is because it's almost as big, And it's near more urban areas. So, for example, if Yellowstone were to erupt, it would definitely have a huge, obviously it would be catastrophic, it would have a huge impact. But because it's a more rural area, the first 500 miles of a supervolcano, everything within 500 miles is dead. And I think, you know, I don't know how far Yellowstone is from any of the major urban zones, but the reason why Long Valley is considered more dangerous is because it's close enough to the major cities in Southern California, where there's, you know, high population. But the other thing is, too, is that there were some research that was done a few years ago here at Scripps Institute in San Diego that showed that there are tectonic links between the San Andreas Fault and Long Valley, meaning that if we have our big one down here that we're always being warned about, an 8 on the Richter scale or above, it could trigger an eruption at Long Valley. Now, that's not the case with Yellowstone. So Long Valley has some unique characteristics that make it really kind of anxiety-provoking for those of us that live in Southern California and into Arizona, and, you know, some real heavy-duty urban areas that would be more affected. But either way, it's going to be, you know, it would be devastating.
Hmm. Wow. So other than Yellowstone and Long Valley, what are some of the others that might be considered as super volcanoes around the world?
Well, there's still the ones that have blown up in the past. There's Lake Taupo, New Zealand. In fact, the lake itself is super volcano. And you can usually tell a super volcano because they're not conical. They're calderas, they're depressed valleys. So, like, there's one in Italy, and none of them are active, though. That's the problem.
You mean Pompeii in Italy?
It's not Pompeii, but it's near that area. There is a very large caldera. The scariest one right now, well, and another thing is they could exist out in the ocean and they haven't even been mapped yet. So that's another possibility, is that there is a massive supervolcano out in the ocean that we don't know about yet, underwater.
Hmm. Atlantis will rise again.
Yeah, La Garita in southwest Colorado, but that's, again, not active at this point. There is a really scary possibility that there is a supervolcano up in the Cascade region in, you know, Oregon, Washington, where they also have Mount St. Helens, which is active now and then. And they also have a lot of earthquake activity because it's on the Ring of Fire. And so just a few years ago, a story came out saying that they believe there might be under Mount St. Helens and in that region, a very large caldera. Now, if that's the case, that's almost worse than what we're dealing with Long Valley, because they have a lot of massive earthquake activity right off the ocean, even up towards Alaska, where you're still going to get the tectonic plate movement. You're going to get tidal waves. So they're sitting on a landmine up there. And it's a beautiful place to live, but I don't know if it's worth it. Crater Lake is another. I think there's about 30 supervolcano calderas, most of which are completely dead, or, you know, they're not even dormant. They're dead.
Dead.
Dead. No magma. They just, you know, happened millions and millions of years ago. Nothing to worry about.
Well, some
so
of
the ones that we worry about are the ones here in California. Yeah, really nice, huh?
So if one of those blew, let's say, what kind of chances would we have in the Midwest and East of surviving, and what would we have to do to be able to survive? How long would we have before we would have to, you know, be hidden underground or something?
Well, unfortunately, you guys have it the worst. The reason being, if either let's take Yellowstone. So if Yellowstone super erupts, the ash is going to be carried eastward. So everything to the east of Yellowstone is gonna be thrown into a volcanic or nuclear winter. Okay, the sun will be blotted out for months, possibly even over a year, because of the output. I mean, these super volcanoes eject so much crap into the atmosphere, and mainly volcanic ash, but you know, rock and fragments of rock, but the amount of ash that they produce can literally create a little a mini ice age, which it's funny because my dad used to say, you know, if you want to solve the climate change, global warming, trigger a super volcano. The problem is you get the exact opposite. So that's not good either. But you in the Midwest would be hit the hardest as it travels eastward. And also because you're in agricultural regions, you know, there would be no such thing as agriculture anymore. I mean, it would cause such damage to crops, to livestock, to water resources. So all the agricultural zones to the east of Yellowstone would be absolutely devastated. Now that ash is going to be carried all across, you know, all around the globe. It'll come back, circle around on itself. And then when it hits those winds that, you know, send it down into the southern hemisphere, they'll start feeling some of the damage too, but they're not going to feel anywhere near as much as the people to the immediate east of Yellowstone will feel it. And that includes the whole country. So how do you prepare for that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so, you know, the next book I'm writing, ironically enough, is an emergency disaster survival guide, because I actually have a lot of training through the fire department, and I've trained through the police department, and I know how to, you know, do all that stuff. But you can only protect yourself so much. Your best bet would be to have a nice, fully supplied underground bunker that can keep you, you know, fed with water and protected for over a year. Because even though the ash will eventually dissipate, there's not going to be any more infrastructure left. You know, it's not like once the ash dissipates, the cargo is going to start coming back into your stores.
Right.
That's not going to happen. It'll take you back to the Stone Age, basically. And the rebirth of the infrastructures needed for everything to go back to normal will take a long, long time. So it's almost like you prepare to the point where you can. And if you don't have an underground bunker, we get enough warning. You know, we can maybe protect ourselves for a while from the external ash. But you can't stay indoors forever because you may not have enough food and water. And now, of course, the minimum food and water that you should have is 2 weeks per person.
Well, that wouldn't be.
But it's going to be. It wouldn't be enough.
Yeah.
That's maybe enough for, you know, a mid-sized earthquake or a volcanic eruption that doesn't qualify as a super volcano. But, you know, you'd have to have months and months worth of food and water. You'd have to have medications, prescription meds that you take that you might die if you don't take them, like blood pressure meds and diabetes medications.
Right.
You have to think about your pets. If they survive, they need food. So ideally, you just do the best you can. I think it's probably more important that people plan to survive smaller emergencies, because we know we're going to be dealing with those. And, you know, what's going to happen if on the news tomorrow they say Yellowstone is going to erupt next week? There's going to be such riots and anarchy and chaos and banks overrun and people, you know, people getting their money out, and then grocery stores will literally be out of supplies within minutes So even if we get warning, because we are human beings who like to panic and freak out, I still don't know that you're going to be able to get enough, you know, stuff to survive on afterwards. So it's good to have some of it on hand, I guess.
Wow. Now we
dust off those bomb bunkers because
you know what? Honest to God, people used to be such a joke, but those are probably those are good for a lot of things. After storm cellars, if you can stock up a bunch of food and water, and then find a way to get the door boarded up so that you're down in there and you've got air somehow coming through and maybe being filtered. But the bunkers, those are good for so many things. I mean, we could have a nuclear war before we have a supervolcanic eruption. We could also get hit by an asteroid, asteroid is a supervolcano that comes from space. It's going to kick up just as much, if not more, debris and ash and stuff into the atmosphere that it would black out the sun. So,
wow.
Yeah, bunker sounds, or it's a base. Even if you have a basement, that sounds really good.
Yeah, but then you still got the house on top of the basement, and if it goes,
Cave in. And then you have to worry about your survivor neighbors who may know that you have extra food and water.
Oh, yeah.
And are not. That scares me.
You get a bat and you name it Lucille.
Yeah.
No kidding. Because if nature doesn't get you, your fellow humans will, right?
Yes, it would be total chaos.
It would.
We're going to go ahead and take us a quick break.
When we come back, we have a question from the chat about fault lines, ley lines, and volcanoes.
All right. That sounds very good. So, Jeff, you're going to take us out.
Okay.
And I will bring us back. How does that sound?
Sounds good. You're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with hosts Henry Foister, Ceiling Cap Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's returning awesome guest, Marie D. Jones. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
It's always time for the dead to shine in Hollywood. The legendary Dearly Departed Tours has stepped up their ghostly game by offering the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour. Dearly Departed has long been an orb of hope in the paranormal world, having been featured on television's Haunted History and Haunted Collector. Their terrible tales have been made infamous in Marla Brooks' The Ghosts of Hollywood books. The new Ghosts and Legends Tour is a 10-block, 70-minute dusk-time stroll down the boulevard of broken dreams. You'll be guided through the golden age of Hollywood and see where the unearthly Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and the calamitous Black Dahlia are still said to linger. You'll see Hollywood's gothic hotels, legendary theaters, and restaurants, never forgetting their permanent occupants. No stranger to investigations, Dearly Departed Tours has first-hand knowledge of some of these hauntings. For details of the Hollywood Ghosts and Legends Walking Tour, find Dearly Departed Tours on Facebook, dearlydepartedtours.com, or call 1-855-600-DEAD.
Are you psychic? Do you often have dreams that come true? Do you have an interest in hypnosis or astrology? If you'd like to learn more about classes, events, and books on metaphysics, then go to our website, www.theartofmediumship.com. This is Elaine Kosmeskis, director of the New England School of Metaphysics and author of The Art of Mediumship.
Hi, I am John Zaffis. You are listening to Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network.
Hi, this is Mike from Mr. G's Ice Cream Store in Gettysburg, the most haunted ice cream store in town. Stop in and see us next time you're around. We feature 16 flavors of homemade ice cream made right here in the store. Look forward to seeing you.
This is Master Tarot Card Reader Ken Bogle, and I highly encourage you to tune in every Monday night to the Para-X Radio Network for the Para-Cave, hosted by Matt Gesso, as he goes in search of the truth in the supernatural, metaphysical, mystic, and paranormal. Monday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern, only on the Para-X Radio Network. I never miss it, and neither should you.
Hey there. I don't know if you've heard, but there's a great new radio show on Para-X. Two hosts, 1 hour, and too much fun. Stephanie and Heidi not only talk about the latest goings-on in the supernatural worlds, they live it. They want to hear from you. They want to help you understand and guide you. And they want you to tune in. So, grab a friend or come alone to gather around that metaphysical table with Heidi and Stephanie. If you're interested in the worlds of the unseen, tune in to The Gathering Radio Show, Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Para-X Radio.
So, Tim, around here at Para-X, we're considered oldies because we've been here so long, right?
You know, yeah, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with oldies. In fact, you know what? I really love oldies.
Well, yeah, me too. I mean, it kind of takes me back to a time when my cauldron had training wheels and the Black Cat Lounge was called the Black Kitten Lounge. Sometimes I miss the good old days.
Sis, there's no need to miss them at all, because all you have to do is turn on and listen to Rock with the Shock.
Rock with the Who?
No, little sis. No, not the Who, the Shock.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. Chat room is filling up very nicely, and those listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you. And speaking from around the world, Barbara, where do we have listeners from?
Henry, tonight they're listening from all over the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and our good friend Other Unknown is back.
I wonder if they have to worry about the volcanoes.
I don't know.
Well, we got with us Barbara Duncan.
Yep.
And Jeffrey Gould.
Hello.
And our great guest, Marie D. Jones, who is on here at least once, if not twice a year, something like that. Everybody enjoys her. You are still with us, right?
I'm here. Oh. I was just listening to you say really nice things about me. It's like, oh, do keep going.
And
Maria, I'm just curious, if Yellowstone blew up as a supervolcano, how much more, like, kilotons or whatever it is, compared to, like, say, Mount St. Helens, which was pretty big at its time?
Okay, so the Toba, which was a little smaller than the biggest super, Yellowstone has had several super eruptions, and the last one I believe was about 640,000 years ago. So Toba was a little smaller, and that one was 3,000 times more than Mount St. Helens. So probably 4,000 more, literally, in terms of the, you know, erupted materials that include pyroclastic flow, the ash and debris into the air, 4,000 times more.
Wow.
That's for, but see, here's the thing. So Yellowstone could have a smaller super eruption, but, and Yellowstone can also have some, because the magma is beneath the caldera, what happens is the pressure builds up and it creates what are called vents. So you could have some vents that blow and create a smaller eruption that doesn't necessarily completely destroy the whole caldera and turn into a super eruption. you could have some smaller things that happen, but if the whole shebang were to go, then it would make Mount St. Helens and, you know,
look like
other earthquakes or other volcanoes look like nothing. Like a here in Southern California where we have earthquakes, it could be the difference between a 2 on the Richter scale, which you don't feel, and, you know, something that blows the scale apart, like a 10 or an 11. And I think, you know, the biggest quake ever recorded was a 9.4, 9.5 in Alaska. And, you know, I can't even imagine what a 10 would be. But it's just something that it would just be so catastrophic and so devastating.
Well, now, if you do have questions here in the chat room, you can private chat them to either Ceiling Cat, Jeffrey Gould, or myself. We will get those right over to Marie and get those answered for you. And if you are listening from somewhere else around the world, you can still ask a question if you don't want to come to the chat room, because you can send us a question to theparanormalview@gmail.com and just put attention question, and we will get that answered for you. So now...
Yeah. And right now we have a question in the chat room, and that goes along with the lines. And it was brought up after Northridge and a few of our lovely little quakes we've had out here, like Loma Prieta. Is there a correlation between earthquakes and volcanic eruptions?
Absolutely.
Has anybody mapped ley lines in the United States to see if those actually follow that as a magnetic tracer?
Well, absolutely, yes. You know, all tectonic activity is connected. There are fault lines that, the Ring of Fire obviously is the most active region in the world, and it's big. We all know how big the Ring of Fire is, and volcanic activity can trigger earthquakes and vice versa. Plate movement, it's all related. With ley lines, I think, you know, in ancient times when the Earth's grid system, the electromagnetic energy was being mapped out, that's actually what they were using, was seismically active areas that they could literally sense or feel or record different EM fields from, you know, normal spots where there is no seismic activity. As far as somebody mapping it out, I think there's been quite a few people that have mapped out ley lines. You'd have to, I don't know, you know, offhand who they are, but I've seen maps of ley lines. However, the original ley lines were travel routes. So we have to go back to the more esoteric use of ley lines, which was to map out a grid of the Earth's electromagnetic field where there were hot spots. You know, spots that were considered to be more active, which were also linked to higher UFO sightings and paranormal activity. But the original ley lines, if you were to look that up, you might be disappointed. They were considered to be just travel routes that were worked out from one, you know, town to another, the best way to get from point A to point Z. But in terms of the more metaphysical, spiritual ley lines, I'm sure somebody's mapped them out. One of my favorite sites for stuff like that is Crystal Links, crystallinks.com. They always have, you know, grid information on the Earth's grid system. So that might be somewhere to look. And, you know, people that go to Sedona, I have never been, believe it or not, but people that go to Sedona, somebody told me they sell ley line maps there. So I don't know where, but I'm sure there's maps.
There are definitely plate tectonic
maps that you could look up too and maybe compare them yourself.
There's essentially one little downtown section of Sedona, which is just a little sidewalk of stores that sell all sorts. I didn't know about ley line maps.
Yeah, somebody told me that because years ago I was trying to find a map. The other thing is the vortices, you know, the 12 different vortice points, those are supposed to match up as well.
Yeah.
But somebody told me that they sell all that stuff in Sedona. And I'm sure, you know, you don't have to go all the way there. Look online. Probably buy them online. But
you could go to Sedona. It's a beautiful, it's a fantastic.
I would love to. I don't know why I've never gotten there yet.
It's great hiking. So I spent a weekend up there several years ago, and it was fantastic. And it is very laid back because it's very new age community, and very not so laid back. They're all like the stereotypical 1960s hippie dropouts, but you know they're very into the energies and the both vortices and the.
Other
energy conduits and such.
So I'm looking right now and I see YouTube has a bunch of ley line grids, you know, where people go through them and show where they are in relationship with fault lines and tectonic boundaries and stuff like that. So thank you, internet. Everything's on the internet.
Yeah, at least.
But yeah, so, I mean, obviously, it makes sense that anything that happens beneath our feet, it's all connected, and oftentimes one can trigger the other. Those are called hot spots.
Yeah, at least until one of them blows, and then you won't have no more internet.
Well, take
yeah, that's true. But then we have beautiful islands like Hawaii. I mean, if you think about it, the Hawaiian Islands were formed. They're volcanoes that emerged out of the ocean, and now we just love to go there and do the tourist thing.
Right.
So,
now some of the Hawaiian islands have active volcanoes, and some are just there. They're dead, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's some places where you can go stand, and, a few hundred feet away, there's lava flowing. Yeah. I'm not sure I would want to do that. But
one of the shows on either like Destination Truth or one of those channels did a thing about purchasing property in Hawaii, and they show the big island broken into these sectors that indicate the amount of danger from lava flows that And it, you don't want to get sector one because that's where the lava goes normally, and then it goes down to seven or eight, it's like, this would be probably a safer place to build your house.
Well, I think I remember seeing one of those, and they literally showed, this couple standing there with their beautiful home that they bought a few years ago, and here comes the creeping lava. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, did you not know that might be a possibility when you move there? I mean, I admit, anybody would love to live there, but when you live that close to the source, I don't know, because literally they were being told your home is going to be, bye-bye. Immersed in lava anytime soon. But, people just want to live where it's beautiful, and they don't think about those things.
Well, yeah, it's like living at the edge of a woods and then wonder why bears show up at your front porch.
Yes, or there's a mountain lion on your patio,
Right. Well, we aren't living out in the woods. Yeah, but you're on the edge of it. Things like that happen. So
I live on a golf course, and I wonder why there's golfers in my backyard. But, we have coyotes and... for some reason, coyotes and mountain lions that we have up in the mountains, they love to come to golf courses. And because there's a lot of bunnies and squirrels, and we have a lot of raccoons and possums, and a lot of little critters live on golf courses, and a lot of birds. And so, we either share and understand that Mother Nature was here first, or we have a problem. But, I remember seeing that show thinking, I don't really feel sorry for you people because you should have known that.
Well, that's something that the realtor should have kind of explained. You're in
sector that's
one.
Like buying a house It's like, 10 people were murdered in this house. It could possibly be haunted, but just saying.
Yeah, but how many of our audience would be like, that's a selling point.
I know, really, right? I'll buy it.
Here's my bid, But like with volcanoes, yeah, it's like, no, I would be like, I want to make sure I'm on the opposite side of where, you know, where it comes down, you know, at very worst, where maybe where I could get a view of it coming from the side and going away from me, but definitely yeah. not just coming at me like the blob and saying, well, CO2 ain't going to handle this blob, you know. So.
But you know what? I say that, and I live in Earthquake Central. I mean, Southern California. So I think that really, no matter where you are in the world, you know, you're going to deal with something, whether it's earthquakes, volcanoes, blizzards, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. And you just sort of have to take your chances, right?
We're a decade or two behind a big earthquake. We should have had...
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you know, it was like, when, you know, I'd rather have a lot of little ones that just sort of like knock snacks off the shelf as opposed to like, well, I'm done holding it in, blah, you know, and then just, you know, buildings come crashing down on people or some of the highways, the highways are built in such a way that, they're kind of retrofitted, so they shouldn't break as much. But that doesn't mean they're not going to become instantaneously unsafe for months.
Well, yeah, they're a little late. Get on that, because I like that show. I get really nervous when we haven't felt an earthquake in a while, and I would rather feel a few 4 and 5s than not have anything. Because then you're just thinking, okay, it's building up. It's building up. Oh.
So if one of these super volcanoes, a real big super volcano, decided to blow its top, would that force from the eruption and everything, would that be enough to knock the Earth out of its orbit?
Oh.
No, absolutely not. No, the only thing that's going to do that is an asteroid impact.
Hmm.
Or Dalek.
It can cause some wobble. You know, it can definitely, when you have that big of a breakup of the Earth's plates, it can definitely shake the planet up a little, but it's not going to knock it out of its orbit. So that's going to require some kind of external, what do they say, you know, an object.
External force.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you.
Well, I was watching one of the Ancient Aliens things, and they were pointing out about how the alignment of the pyramids were like centimeters off of true north. And then somebody realized that when they were considering that the Earth kind of wobbles a little bit over the centuries, that when it was built, it probably was absolutely spot on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We have what do they call it? The precession, the wobble. That causes the precession of the equinox.
Yeah,
so that's natural.
Aren't there Alaskan tribes that are now saying that the Earth is changing, the stars look different, so that there is a wobble happening?
Yeah, and that's been, every 25,000 years, I think, it occurs.
You're talking about the polar shift?
No.
The flip?
Oh, just the wobble itself. Oh. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we do wobble on our axis.
We don't fall down.
But we don't fall down. But you know, to knock something out of orbit, oh, you're talking heavy duty impact. And that would be something external. Comet, asteroid, another planet, Planet X. You know, a gigantic UFO, or who knows? But yeah, add that
to
the list.
They are looking at that. Astronomers are finding that shadow that they think might be a 10th planet. So
yeah, they always seem to find, you know, these new planets, and then you still hear people say, "No, there's no way there could be other life out there." Really? I mean, we're just scratching the tiny tip of the iceberg here, folks.
Yeah, we don't even
know
what's
so much
underneath.
More out there.
In the depths of the ocean, So how can we possibly think out there has nothing? I think it's ego. I don't know if it was Arthur C. Clarke or Stephen Hawking saying that either we're alone in the universe or we're not. Either way, it's terrifying.
It is, kind of. I mean, you have to hope that the people that come to visit us the most often are the nice, friendly ones, the nice, friendly tourists. Yeah. But, you know, we have no guarantee of that.
The coolest thing they found is that there is water under the lunar surface.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if there's water, there's life forms like us or similar.
Or it could be, right. It's they keep they found ice on Saturn's or Jupiter's moons. They found ice and traces of water. And
I thought that was Io. Like,
was it Io? Is that Europa Neptune?
Europa.
Wow.
And then all the exoplanets that they're finding that are really similar to Earth. And again, we're just scratching the surface of only what is in our, you know, what the Hubble can see and what's in our sort of immediate vicinity. We have no idea what else is out there. And then if you think that, you know, quantum physicists say, well, there are parallel universes and there could be an infinite number of them. Well, okay.
Yeah,
that sure opens up a lot of doors.
If you want to know about those, all you got to do is pick up one of Marie's books.
Yes, mind-boggling stuff, I tell you. I have a hard time existing in this universe. I don't know how I can fare in, you know, 200 of them. In one of them, could I please be, you know, rich?
When were questions?
Good looking and rich. But yeah,
nothing from the chat room yet.
All right. I think what we'll do is take us our last little break and just let Marie remember that your mic will be live. So you will know.
Don't say any bad words. Okay.
Yeah. Don't.
I won't.
You know. Jeff's going to take us out. I'll bring us back. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about the power of archetypes.
Ooh. So you're listening to The Paranormal View on para-x.com with hosts Henry Foyster, Ceiling Cat Barbara Duncan, and myself, Jeffrey Gould, with tonight's returning guest, Marie P. D. Jones. So stay tuned for more of The Paranormal View after the break.
I found it at last! Marla's Sacred Cauldron. This is the legendary artifact that has been whispered about in hushed tones for hundreds of years, and now it's mine! All mine!
Who dares defile the sanctity of my castle walls? Step away from the cauldron, you impertinent, muddy metal maltworm.
Never! I've spent half my lifetime trying to discover your age-old secret of stirring the cauldron.
Oh, for Merlin's sake, that's no deep, dark secret. Just tune into the Para-X Radio Network Thursday nights at 9 o'clock Eastern for more cauldron stirring than you can shake a wand at.
Oh, well, in that case, I guess I don't need to take up any more of your time, so I guess I'll be going.
Not just yet. We've got a little unfinished business to take care of.
That's Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Para-X Radio Network.
There's magic brewing behind the scenes at Stirring the Cauldron, a new exclusive line of incense and essential oils created by master alchemist Jimmy Darling at Babylon Gardens Apothecary. The Stirring the Cauldron essential oil brings you knowledge and success. Use it in all forms of spell work, or wear it to create a perfect aspect of the self. The Witch's Oracle incense enhances veil wisdom and prediction when used in readings with Marla Brooks' Witch's Oracle deck. but we've found it to be an extremely powerful tool in any form of divination. Create the ultimate connection to the divine when using this custom blend. The newest offering in the Stirring the Cauldron line is Love Potion number 9 3/4. This isn't your average love potion. It's a love thyself potion of attraction, which empowers you to draw not only love and romance into your life, but anything else your heart desires. Love Potion number 9 3/4 is available in both essential oil and incense forms. To find out more about the Stirring the Cauldron line of products, please go to www.marlabrooks.com and click on the Incense and Oils tab.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the Paranormal View, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kinds of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear. Line!
You gotta be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
There's a darkness in the hallway. Voices that seem to come from nowhere. Alone at night, there is a feeling that something or someone is near. Where can you go? Who can you turn to? Para-X Radio. Our knowledgeable host and expert guest can help you find some answers and take a glimpse into the unknown. Para-X Radio, programming for the open mind.
And welcome back, everybody, right here to the Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. I want to thank everybody for being here tonight. Hope you're enjoying the show. And those listening from around the world, we appreciate each and every one of you also. We got, of course, with us Jeffrey Gould.
Hello.
And Barbara Duncan.
I'm still here.
And we're bringing back Marie D. Jones. She hasn't got tired of us yet, I don't think.
Not quite. Not yet. Of course not.
Not yet. Yeah. I sent Marie a message and I said, you know, if you're free, I'm begging you or something like that if you wanted to be on the show. And she said, you don't have to beg me.
Nah, you don't have to beg. I don't like begging.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to be talking now about her latest book, The Power of Archetypes. And I know Barbara has about 3 pages of questions. This is right up her alley. So, Barbara?
Well, I just think it's an absolutely fascinating idea and totally agree. And we were talking before the show about how archetypes shaped astrology and the different astrological signs. And I'm sure that you also have figured out that there's, even in pop culture, the archetypes that we gravitate to, and even some of our probably superheroes
are archetypal.
Yeah.
Well, that's what made me write this book. So here's how this book came about, because obviously it's a lot different than most of my other books. It's probably closest to Destiny versus Choice. But how it came about is I was sitting around one day trying to figure out why shows like the Game of Thrones, The Walking Dead, you know, certain movies are, why are they so popular? What is it? It's not just good acting and writing and zombies and this and that. There's something deeper. And it just really struck me that it is the archetypal characters that we relate to. We don't even know what's happening. I think it happens on a subconscious level. And so I looked at The Walking Dead, and all of a sudden it made so much sense. Whether you like zombies or not, it's a show about people trying to survive. And they're not just trying to survive zombies, they're trying to survive their fellow humans. That's always the worst threat. And I began to see each, you know, character. If you don't watch the show, then you won't know what I'm talking about. But even if you take a show like Game of Thrones or Wonder Woman or any movie or novel or television series that is very successful, they are successful because they have characters that symbolize archetypes, whether it's the hero, the anti-hero, you know, the ultimate villain, the jester, the sidekicks. Oh my gosh, look at Star Wars with C-3PO and R2-D2. Those are the best sidekicks. The goddess, you know, the gods, the child, the innocent, the sage, the mentor. I just began to see every single character. Now, if you don't watch The Walking Dead, you probably have seen Star Wars. And that is one of the most archetypal franchises we've ever had, mainly because George Lucas, the creator, was very much into the work of Joseph Campbell. And Joseph Campbell worked a lot. He was a comparative mythologist who worked a lot with archetypes of the subconscious and the power of symbols in mythology, all the different world myths. So, you know, you can look at, like, Luke Skywalker as being the ultimate hero. Starts out as an innocent child, goes on this quest, meets up with the villain who turns out to be his own father, you know, and has his sidekicks. And you just see all these different characters that resonate with so many millions of people. So that's, I decided, oh, I really need to explore this. And that's kind of what triggered the book. And then also I worked in the recovery movement, counseling women who were addicts and alcoholics. And I began to also see how archetypal symbolism is present in the names and the labels that we buy into, such as I'm an alcoholic, I'm an addict, you know, I'm a this, I'm a that, and how we buy into those symbols and we don't let go of them, even though they may be destroying us. So those are the real reasons behind why I sort of veered away from the usual stuff I write about and took this book on.
Marie, are you talking into your microphone on the phone?
Yeah, I am. Can you not hear me?
Yeah, it kind of fades away, and I didn't know if you was kind of like turning away from it or what.
I thought it was just me.
No, I'm doing my whirling dervish spins. I'm just kidding. Oh, it's technology, I tell you. Listen, hey, we have new archetypes now of technology geeks, right? Nerds and geeks and gamers.
Well, that's what if you look at Neil Gaiman's American Gods, he kind of yes. discusses that with the techno boy and the new media as being replacing some of the old myths of actual gods.
Yes, exactly. That's one of my favorite books. I started to watch the series and then I fell behind, but it's such a perfect example of showing different archetypal symbols in human form. And you know, we can trace archetypes back, mainly to Carl Jung, the Swiss psychologist and psychoanalyst. Oh, I'm losing my voice. because he really sort of laid the groundwork with working with archetypes and identifying them and how they affect the collective unconscious and our personal subconscious. But today we see new evolving archetypes and symbols of things that make sense to us no matter where we are in the world. I mean, I think that somebody in Japan and someone in Norway and someone in the United States understand what it means to be a geek. They may have a different word for it, but they understand there is a universal quality to the concept of a geek or a nerd. We're giving rise to new archetypes that are now defining us as human beings.
What about when you get into the level of comic books? Especially, well, characters that weren't gods before, but people like the Hulk.
They sure are now.
Yeah, they sure are now.
Iron Man.
Yeah.
Pop culture, boy, you know, I mean, it's just so rampant with superheroes and even villains and anti-heroes. And, you know, that's where we get to really bring out our imagination. And I think let the symbolic parts of us come out to play. So in our comics and our TV shows and in our fiction, you know, our novels and in the movies that we like to go to, the entertainment, what appeals to us the most are these archetypal symbols that we're all familiar with. It doesn't matter where you are in the world or what your cultural background is, or if you're rich or poor, you understand the concept of Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman, you know, and the heroicism or the anti-heroicism in the case of some of the Batman movies. And I think that because entertainment has always been so important to us, that's where we see it most visibly. Mm-hmm. And comic books, you know, they started so much of it. I mean, they don't get that much credit anymore. The franchises are now all about the movies, but really, you know, comic books created these new gods and goddesses that we are now all worshiping at the box office.
Can we talk a little bit about the rise of the anti-hero? It seems to me that, even the darker Batman also carries that sense of ennui, that sense of darkness that a lot of people are resonating to these days.
Well, there's a movie coming out next week, The Dark Tower, from Stephen King's book series, and I don't know how the movie's going to be. The book series is my absolute all-time favorite book series because Roland Deschain, who is the lead, you know, is an anti-hero. He's not a hero. He's more of a person who breaks the rules and even kills people, and yet he's doing it for heroic purposes or for a heroic motivation. And these types of movies and stories are becoming really popular because I think a lot of us got sick of always, you know, looking at and dealing with the sort of bubblegum hero, you know, the happy-go-lucky hero that saves everybody and is wonderful and never sins and doesn't even cuss and, you know, it's just so perfect. We wanted to dirty up our heroes a little so that they are more like us, because sometimes our motives or our intentions may be pure, but the methods we take to fulfill them may not be. And so in the Dark Knight, you have a person who is heroic in some sense, but who's also not a very good guy in others. And Roland Deschain, who will be played by Idris Elba in the movie, he does kill people, and he will stop at nothing to achieve his goal, but his goal is one of saving the world. So, you know, how do we qualify that person as a bona fide hero? Because really they are taking on both the role of villain and hero at the same time. And yeah, you're right, it's becoming very popular because I think we get to explore the shadow side of ourselves as well as the good guy side.
Well, the interesting thing about Star Wars for me was I know Lucas wrote them for younger audiences where things needed to be black and white. You needed a good hero and you needed a really bad, you know, villain. But life isn't always so black and white.
No, it
isn't. You need to have those shades of gray in there.
Absolutely. My son told me something really interesting, and somebody could correct me if he's wrong and I'm wrong. But, you know, we were talking about the Jedi. We were talking about, well, why is the next one called The Last Jedi? What is, you know, what does that mean? And he said, oh, well, you know, don't you know in the Star Wars mythology, Jedi were not really the good guys. They started out good, but in their quest for, you know, purity or whatever, they ended up doing a lot of really bad things. Now, I didn't know because I watch the movies, but I don't read all the novels and everything. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So in other words, the Jedi were so good on the outside, but the tactics that they're using were almost those of anti-heroes.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see if the next, and again, I could be wrong, but that's what he told me. And it'll be interesting to see if The Last Jedi is about having to sort of look at the Jedi movement and say, wait a minute, you know, we're not as good as we think we are.
Well, the thing is that, and a lot of articles I read bear out that concept, is that the Jedi have no problem lying through their teeth to further their own ends. And yet, I don't think we've ever heard Darth Vader or the Emperor, any Sith Lord, lie. Everything they've ever said is upfront, straight on the nose, this is how it is, and there you go. And they've always never lied. They've always told the truth, which is why Luke is so freaked out when he finds out, because Obi-Wan doesn't say, and I won't even get into the concept that Vader shouldn't have been his father. That will take up an entire show. But Obi-Wan says, you know, literally refers to Vader and Luke's father as two separate entities. And and that he betrayed and murdered your father. Not like, oh, he became evil and became somebody else and therefore his good self was killed. No, he specifically clarified. And then later he tries to say, well, you know, what I told you was true from a certain point of view. And he said, no, you lied through your teeth.
truth is relative.
Or a meme I just saw, he says, you said Vader betrayed and murdered my father. And Obi-Wan said, I gave you an alternative fact. He goes, what did you just say? What?
There you go, alternative fact. I think that's fascinating. And I actually would be really, I would love to see that played out. Because Star Wars, again, is so filled with archetypes, but it did miss that shade of gray because it was trying to be too black and white, I think, at first. And maybe people were disappointed. But if they evolve into where they can look at their own sins, you know, and hey, we like to call ourselves the good guys, but some of our tactics rival those of, you know, the Sith and Darth Vader and all the people that we consider our enemies, that's a really interesting avenue for them to go down. And there again, it's the appeal of the anti-hero. Because I think more of us, yes, movies like Iron Man, Wonder Woman, they're all great and wonderful, but how many of us can really truly relate to those as much as we can to someone who is deeply flawed, trying to do the right thing, but maybe, you know, breaking the laws and the rules as they're trying to do it. We get that a lot more.
So I guess you've seen Wonder Woman.
I haven't yet.
But
from what I've heard,
fantastic. Makes up for every bad DC movie of recent.
That's what I've heard.
It really
does. But again,
does.
You know, again, from what I understand, she's good. She's a good person.
She's excellent. But she also has, and you will love the archetype aspect of it, because when she faces down the antagonist she's been looking for, they have this incredible discourse, almost Vader-esque, in that, you know, this is what I'm doing. And it's sort of like, doesn't it make sense? You know, and it's very much a, you know, see whether or not, you know, you want to go with what you think is holier than thou as opposed to what I'm doing, and what I'm doing is different from what you think I'm doing. And it's very much an interesting, I really want to see it again.
Very archetypal. And the thing is, you know, it brings up a really good point with how we see ourselves. We all like to see ourselves as the good guys. The villains think they're doing the right thing in their mind. And that they see themselves as heroes.
Yeah, we still keep voting them into office. Oh, wait.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, but the funny thing is that a villain will truly believe that they're the hero. They're the ones that are trying to make things right. And you good guys, you're the villains. You're standing in my way of what I want and what I need. And how we the archetypes that we live by, that we believe are at work in ourselves, can be nothing but illusion or the spin that we put on the truth. You know, because the truth is, if you're a jerk, you're a jerk. But, you know, the spin that we put on that might be, well, I'm a jerk, but I give a lot to charity, so I'm a nurturing, you know, wonderful person.
Oh, yeah.
Now, these symbols that you talk about, what are they, and how do we use them? Do we even know if we're using them?
I think we obviously are using them, but most of what programs our behaviors and our actions is in the subconscious, and therefore it's like autopilot. We're totally unaware of it. And that's kind of a sad thing to say, because it means that we have so little control and so little thought is put into what we're actually doing. We just sort of operate on programming that was put into us by peers and parents and society and culture and politics and religion. We never even really question it. The archetypes, when we really start to look at the ones that are active in our own lives, it can be very eye-opening. Now, Jung had his main archetypes, which were the self, which is the fully actualized individual, you know, the whole individual. The shadow, which was the dark sort of repressed side that needs to be integrated with the self at some point for you to be a whole authentic individual. The anima and animus, which is basically the female aspects in men and the male aspects in women. And those really should balance out somewhere, be harmonious. The innocent, the child, how there is a child within all of us that is still innocent and pure and looks at the world through childlike eyes. The wise sage, it could be a wise old woman or a wise old man. Gods and goddesses, the mother, the nurturing mother, the authoritative father. And then over time, a lot of other people in the fields of psychology, therapy, personal growth or transformation added on, just out of recognizing in our own behavioral patterns, more archetypes, diva, mentor, teacher, leader, follower, victim, martyr, demon, you know, the devil is one of the biggest archetypes. Adventurer, you know, just, there's anything that you could really use to describe a human being in a sort of symbolic way has become an archetype. Like I said earlier, even geek, maiden, you know, old crone. oh gosh, there's so many.
Radio show.
I think betrayer, beast, radio show host, artist, you know, the alpha dog.
By the way,
the diplomat.
The trio you got stumbled on is maiden, mother, crone.
Mother and crone. There you go. The genius. You know, there's just healer. There's so many. So basically what it comes down to is trying to identify what we're calling ourselves or what we have bought into and believed. And a lot of the ways that you can do that is really just paying more attention to your own behavior, your life, the patterns that have emerged. The things that you whine and complain about, are you always calling yourself a victim? Well, boom, there's your archetype. Are you a martyr? Are you always doing things for other people and then whining and complaining because they don't do anything for you? You know, are you a doormat? Are you a warrior? Are you always saving everybody else, but no, you know, nobody ever takes care of you? Are you the leader? You're always, no matter what happens, you end up leading every meeting that you go into, every organization you join. You lead, you lead, you lead. Or are you somebody that likes to follow? You just kind of look at the behaviors and patterns that have emerged in your own life. Ask if those are really truly who you are. And if not, you set about to change them. You can replace them. If I consider myself to be a victim, I have the power and the ability to turn myself into more of a warrior. And you don't want to ever go to one extreme or another. You want to find a balance. But if I start working on the victimhood that I have bought into my whole life, I can begin to identify and break the pattern and become more of a warrior, more of a goddess, more of a leader, you know, more of a hero. And there's a lot of different exercises in the book, some that were mine and some that were taught to me by other people in different fields that are just really wonderful ways to go, oh, you know, no wonder I'm always broke. I have bought into the archetype of being, you know, poor. And you can have situational archetypes too. I've bought into, you know, being the caretaker for everybody. And I'm exhausted and I want it to stop. So you really think about the words and symbols by which you identify yourself or how other people identify you. That's always really telling. You know, are there key words that people who know you sort of have now associate you with? Because that can be really telling as well.
And in a way, it seems to also shape children when they go to these movies. I mean, how many kids went out and watched Batman and then put on a red cape and ran out thinking they were, or Superman, excuse me.
Yeah.
Went out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
exactly.
Decided that they were going to be Superman. Yeah.
Well, that's where entertainment and pop culture can be both uplifting and destructive. Because, you know, you go and you get entertained and you see symbols. I mean, look at Breaking Bad. You see a teacher who, you know, decided to make his own meth, basically, and came to a very tragic end. What are you going to absorb and emulate? The problem is that we're still absorbing and emulating external influences. The key, and Carl Jung, again, focused on getting to the point of self, self-actualization, trying to find the authentic real you that is buried under layers and layers of crap that other people and society have dumped on you. And all the labels that you have lived with, you've either given them to yourself or other people have given them to you and you bought into them, you know, getting rid of all that, getting... This is who I want to be. I want to be this, 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 and I see myself as this, not the way you see me, or not the way that I used to see myself when I was miserable and unhappy. So that's really how we can work with archetypes and clean out the old symbols that no longer serve us and replace them with ones that do.
I think one of the best movies I saw, which kind of relate to this, was M. Night Shyamalan's Unbreakable. Where he, the Samuel L. Jackson's character in there, actively looks for his opposite. And he's doing all sorts of things. He becomes the anti-hero simply because he's looking for his polar opposite in this case was Bruce Willis, I believe.
But he really...
And in a way, we look for that in other ways, too. We look for our opposites because it defines us as well.
Well, and also I think because we want to come to a sort of harmonious equilibrium between the two. Because if we're all one opposed to the other, we're out of balance. So the idea is to find a sort of happy medium. I don't have to see myself as a martyr. I can be a giving, generous person, but I'm also strong and have boundaries to where I'm not being a victim. You know, you kind of find that blend or that medium point that works for you. Because, you know, even with the archetypes that people think are desirable, like, oh, I want to be a warrior. Well, no, you don't want to be a warrior all the time. You're going to be exhausted if you're always fighting your battles and everybody else's. But I want to change direction just a tiny bit because you mentioned astrological symbols before. And this is a perfect example of how powerful archetypes are and when we don't even realize it. So for years and years, you know, I'm Libra. I was born October 12th. And I've always been identified as a Libra. And I have no balance. I can't make a decision to save my life. You know, all of the typical archetypal symptoms that come with being a Libra. Well, then years ago, I read about Vedic astrology. And in Vedic astrology, you're the sign before the sign that you are in Western astrology. So I'm really a Virgo. And I remember when I read that, it was like all of a sudden, like now I have to act like a Virgo? have to take on these qualities? And it was just so funny because I thought, wow, how attached we get to these, you know, labels and descriptions of, I probably bought into being an indecisive Libra when I was a kid. And maybe that wasn't the case at all. Maybe I really was decisive. I mean, I can make decisions. Obviously, I do all the time. But so if you buy into an archetype to the point where you find that it's really not working well in your life, you do have the ability to change it and to rework it.
It really all depends on how you see the archetype.
Exactly. And, yes.
Yeah. Libras are rather interesting. And when you look at the myth behind Libra, then you look at balance, but you also have to see it's about reflection as well.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with the blind prophet, is it Tiresias? I can never pronounce his name. Tiresias, who was the, he was a friend of Hera. And what they would do is they'd walk through her gardens, uh-huh. and question became once is who enjoyed the mating of these two swans more, the male or the female? And he couldn't figure it out. They couldn't decide. So she turned him into a female for a while. So he had to live both sides of the question.
Right.
And that's kind of where Libra goes to, both sides of the question. When they finally decided, Zeus and Hera asked him the question, well, which one enjoyed it more? He said the female, and Zeus didn't like that, so he blinded them. Well, when you read Greek mythology, when you blind somebody, it means they've come to a self-realization.
Right.
So when you look at your exterior issues, when you look at the people around you, then you look at yourself. Because you see that your reflection in them.
Your reflection, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And then you can decide, do I like that reflection? Do I like what,
exactly.
what's looking back? And you know, you mentioned myth, and oh my gosh, talk about being full of archetypal symbols. Because really, what a great way to convey themes and motifs and mm-hmm. lessons. Because those reach us in the subconscious. We're more affected by that than things that we, you know, sort of consciously respond to. And that's why the programming of the subconscious mind is so important, because most of it, you don't even know where it came from. It's just been dumped into you over time. And then if you don't take it out and look at it, it will drive the rest of your life. And you'll always wonder why you're not happy or you're miserable or unfulfilled or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then to go even deeper into that collective unconscious, as Jung called it, where we're all connected, you begin to realize that the archetypes that we take on don't just affect us, they affect everybody, because we're all connected at that level. And so if we do the hard work of empowering ourselves, in a way, we're empowering all of humanity. We're adding into that the collective unconscious. We're adding in good stuff. But most of us don't take the time to even reflect on, gee, you know, I have these patterns of behavior, and I'm just now kind of seeing, you know, where they came from and how I should probably stop them. We just don't take the time to do that.
Yeah. And
it's hard.
To the point where, yeah. You had mentioned, oh my God, I have to be a Virgo now. And an astrologer would tell you, but you are Virgo. You are Virgo in certain parts of your life.
Yes.
Which brings
yes.
back to the whole archetypal circle of 12 archetypes. You are each of those archetypes, just in a different part of your life.
Right, because aren't there different houses and my moon sign, and there's, you know, this aspect of this. Because people, when they think of astrology, they just automatically think of their sun sign and what they read in the horoscope in the newspaper or online or whatever. And you know, it even goes for, like, Native American animal symbols and Chinese animal symbols. You know, the year of the rat is different from the year of the boar or whatever. Those animal symbols mean very specific things. This year will be a year of this, this, and this. And, it, you know, so every culture has that utilize these archetypes in some way or another. Chinese astrology, same thing. So they're affecting our lives all the time, but we're not aware of it. We still think of archetypes in terms of what we read in high school. You know, the little reading we did about Freud and Jung. Oh, archetypes. Yeah, I kind of remember that vaguely. But they're really a part of who we are, or who we think we are. Mm-hmm.
Or who we want to be.
Yeah, because I think, you know, how many of us are really who we thought we would be or who we wanted to be? We got waylaid along, detoured along the path so many times, and now we're so distracted and busy and tired that we don't really want to sit down and think, oh, gee, who am I really? Oh, I'll just keep going as I have been. I'm still alive.
So do you think that that's where we tend to idolize people, put them up on pedestals, especially movie stars, sports heroes, etc., because they fulfill those archetypes?
Oh my gosh, celebrity. There's a giant archetype, right? Absolutely. We worship them. We want to be like them. Excuse me. We ascribe all kinds of positive traits and characteristics to them, even though they can be killers and drug dealers and pedophiles and, you know, beating their wives. We think celebrities are gods and goddesses. Going back to the American gods, you know, along with the tech geniuses of today, the Elon Musks, and, you know, we have these celebrities, some of whom I don't even know what they did to become celebrities, and I'm sure you know who I'm talking about, that we just sort of throw money at. We put them on pedestals, and we want to know every move they make, and we worship them as the new gods and goddesses. And, you know, unfortunately, I think it's to the detriment of our young people, because what are we showing them? We're showing them that the people that we think are worth showering love and affection and wealth and fame upon are these people.
So how is there a correction? I mean, certainly down the right road, society must be able to correct that function.
Yeah.
And I know,
No, I agree with you, and it has to be done on the collective. I think the more individuals that correct their own course, obviously there'll be a tipping point where society will begin to balance out much differently. But it has to be a conscious effort on behalf of individuals to work on themselves first. And, you know, activism and the internet, you know, social networking, bringing people together to try to make the world a better place in so many different ways, is a way that you can build that collective and change the archetypes that represent, you know, we see in politics and religion. And the collective archetypes can change just as much as your personal ones can. It just requires a lot more people working towards that goal.
Do you think that there is, especially with the explosion of the internet, things like YouTube, where you do have people who try to get those 15 minutes, are expressing themselves, or is it more of a shout?
Oh, gosh, it's a lot of noise. Everybody wants their 15 minutes. I remember that, you know, years and years ago, Andy Warhol saying that, and now more than ever, it's gotten to the point where it's absolutely ridiculous. Do we really need to see every, you know, little goofy family video that somebody took. Some are absolutely hilarious, yes, but people have suddenly come to believe that every moment of their lives are worthy of being put out in the public or put on video. And that's not true. You know, what we're doing is we're taking away some of the mystique of what it means to be a human being, just throwing all our laundry and our garbage out there for everybody to see. And it's not all that interesting. I think, you know, the YouTube revival hopefully is going to be on the downswing. It's just gotten absolutely ridiculous. Some of the things that I see, it's like, why did this particular person think that anybody would care about this? You know, it's not something truly remarkable. We have lowered the bar in society for remarkable, extraordinary behaviors and actions. And I know that sounds really judgmental, but I think most people will agree with me. It's gotten to the point where it's ridiculous. I don't need to see, you know, you clipping your toenails. That's not YouTube worthy. And yet you'll see stuff like that all the time. Because everybody wants to aspire to that celebrityhood that being put on a pedestal, being famous, and having attention and acknowledgement. We all want that. But it's gotten, that particular archetype has really gone to the extreme and needs to be recalibrated.
Yeah, I don't even want to see myself clipping my toenails.
I don't want to see, you know, the word celebrity has become a joke. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, when I was little, and then thinking about, like, my grandmother would talk about the movie stars of the 20s and 30s, and they were real stars. And now it's just like everybody can be a star because everybody can go on Facebook or YouTube and post a little video. Now, all of a sudden, that the archetype of celebrity has become something quite different. And the idea of a star, the glamour is gone. The mystique is gone. As a means of self-expression, sure, I guess it's a positive thing. But does every single thing that you do have to be expressed? No. If we need that kind of 24/7 acknowledgement, we're all addicts. There's the archetype. We've all become addicts for acknowledgement. We're addicted to acknowledgement and people going, oh, you know, I like that. I heart that or whatever. And commenting on our posts, and we've become addicted to it.
And it kind of brings up the anti-hero, too, in when you see some reality shows, there's too many not to name, that you wonder, it's like a train wreck, which seems to be an archetype in itself, is those people headed towards those train wrecks.
Yeah, and why do we need to see that? And why do they want us to see that? You know, if my life were derailing, I don't think I'd want anybody to see. And I wouldn't feel the need to put that out there on a reality show. So, again, it's like, where did we cross that line where we came to believe that every single thing we do, good or bad, hero or anti-hero, has to be exposed to the public? And that maybe that's the new archetype. That's the new celebrity. We're all celebrities. You know, maybe that's what that means, but I don't see it necessarily as being a positive.
So can we change our archetypes?
Absolutely. Well, you think about, you know, are you the same person you were as a kid? Maybe some aspects of you are, but a lot of them aren't. You outgrow, you evolve, you learn, you make mistakes, you redirect, you know, you recalibrate. It's like when you're using your GPS and the lady, you know, turn right 500 feet. And then you go, oh, no, I know a better route. I'm going to go here. And then, you know, recalibrate. And then she'll start to tell you the directions from the choice that you made that she didn't tell you to make. That's kind of like life.
I also like when she says, she keeps saying, make a U-turn.
Oh, don't you hate that? Oh, the other night, make a legal U-turn. I'm like, what? Do you think I'm going to make an illegal one? Is that remind me of something? But anyway, that's beside the point. But really, you have the choice. If you don't like the fact that you're browbeaten by your boss and you feel like a victim, because that's one of the biggest archetypes that human beings deal with, is the victim. You hear that, you see it everywhere. But there are ways that you can stop being victimized and feeling victimized. And when you do that, yes, you are changing the symbolic image that you have bought into of yourself. Even if you don't call yourself a victim, you are, if that's the way people are treating you and you're allowing it to happen. Sure, you can change it. It requires a lot of hard work, a lot of honesty, because you've got to be honest enough to first admit, God, I'm a victim, or, I'm a freaking doormat. This has to end. That takes a lot of self-honesty to admit that there are things that we don't like about ourselves that we want to change. But once you do that, then you can change them.
Okay, I'm going out tomorrow and buying me a horse, and I've already got the hat, and I got the boots, but I need the horse.
You can be a cowboy, but you need property. You need a stable. So don't go change your archetypes unless you have the additional things to go with it. If one of your neighbors can stable the horse, then you're fine. But you can still be a cowboy without the horse. Get the boots, the hat, the swagger, and you got it. Learn how to line dance. You'll be perfect.
I don't know about that.
To be a cowboy, you just have to have the cow.
That's true. Or it's just attitude. It's the cowboy attitude. Or attitude. Just have that attitude.
Get yourself a little cow cat, and you'll be fine.
Or what do they call them? Those pants that have no butt part.
Chaps.
Get some chaps. And don't wear anything under them. Then you'll be a cowboy.
Only in San
Well, you got questions for Marie. Now's the time to send them over to either Ceiling Cat or myself, Henry Foister, and we will get those answered for you, because we got a few more minutes left in the show, so time is running out. So if you do got questions, send them to us.
Order for her midnight tonight. Oh wait,
don't ask me what a Virgo is, because I still think of myself as a Libra.
Oh, you know the best way to win an argument with a Virgo?
How?
You kick a throw rug out of the way and see how long it takes for them to dive down to correct it. Put it back into place.
Oh, are they like OCD-ish? Or?
Sort of, yeah. They like order,
really?
And neatness and stuff.
Order. Oh, see, that's not me. I'm not. But see, Libra is supposed to be into aesthetics and fine art, and I can't stand fine art.
Well,
I'm like, oh, what?
But you're very spatially oriented, right? You're able to take a bunch of stuff and fit them in a box that nobody else can do. So that there's no air.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a Libra thing. My former Libra girlfriend used to be able to do that. We had she had to go out to do something, and her mom's boyfriend and I had to put all this stuff into a trailer for her to move. And there was this one big item that we couldn't fit. And my girlfriend comes back. She's like, she pretty much almost empties the entire thing, puts everything back in like Tetris, and it's like everything fit. And we're like,
that is a trait. Spatial, conceptual, bigger picture. And also, I've been a little justice freak since I was a kid, and I always wondered why. And when I was writing this book, I thought, I wonder if that's tied into my being a Libra, because the balancing of the scales, the seeking of justice. So, where do all these traits come from?
What's Aquarius?
Airhead.
Aquarius is supposed to be inquisitive. They're the water bearer. Let's see, what have I heard about Aquarius? Open-minded, into personal transformation. I don't know. Barbara might know more than me on that
that's
one.
That's pretty good.
But their heads,
pretty good. The universals.
Their heads tend to be in the clouds a lot, though.
They can be airy, yes. They're an air sign. You're right. But so is Libra, right? Libra, Aquarius and Gemini are here. And my brother's Gemini, my sister's Aquarius, and I'm Libra. So we're all airheads.
That's what they say about me, I guess. You know, I'm always in a cloud.
That's how I am. Always head up in the clouds. That's how I write. You know, you create up in the clouds and you sit down and put it down on paper.
So, Henry, what sign is Patsy?
She is...
Just tell her what her birthday is.
I think she said is Aries.
Yeah, that's what it is, Aries. Yeah. Hmm.
That's a flip.
She's a fire sign.
Yeah, that's a flip side of Libra, though, too. So, yeah. Well, I guess we know who has the pants in that family, then. Okay, never mind.
Thank you.
The Aries, right?
There it is again. See, comes right out, don't it? All right, we're down to 4 minutes. Barbara, did you have one last short question that you wanted to ask?
Not that would take very short.
Yeah, really. What's your favorite color? Blue.
All right, then. Well, we wanted to take time to thank Marie for coming on to be with us tonight. She's always a delight to come on because we can just ask one question and she can talk forever. So that's the way we like it.
That's my archetype. I'm talkative.
Well,
Chatty Kathy.
She's always informative, though. And I mean, she's got such great books and everything. So that's why we like to get her on. So hopefully she'll...
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, hopefully you'll come back again sometime.
Uh-oh. What's going on?
I don't know.
I mean, I just hope we ain't scared you off, you know, and you don't want to...
No. In fact, I have another book coming out in September called Demons, the Devil, and Fallen Angels. That's the history of demons and the devil. That might be fun. Ooh, that will be a fun conversation.
Be great.
Yes.
That'll be...
The devil is the youngest, one of the youngest deities out there. He's only about 1,500 years old.
Yeah, and he's an archetype as well.
Yep.
You little devil.
As soon as it comes out, we'll see about getting you booked again. So.
Sounds good. You guys are always wonderful.
Well, we appreciate it. Thank you. We got 2 minutes left. Why don't you give all your information out where people can get your books and get in contact with you if they need to, and all the good stuff.
All that good stuff. Well, my website is mariedjones.com, and I'm on Facebook at Marie D. Jones Author, and I'm on Twitter at Marie D. Jones, and Instagram at Marie D. Jones. And the books should be available in any regular brick-and-mortar bookstore and all the usual online outlets. And I also understand a lot of my books are getting into libraries, too. So if you would rather visit your local library, if you still have one, then you can find them there as well. And most of them are eventually come out on audiobook, too.
Excellent. Jeff, you want to give out all our stuff?
Oh, essentially, just go to our website, theparanormalview.com, and get all kinds of links. And on Facebook, just do go to facebook.com/theparanormalview, all one word, and you'll get to our wonderful page, the community, not magazine. And when I find cool stuff, I post articles throughout the week.
Excellent. Barbara?
You can catch all of our links on the Paranormal View page, and check out the Facebook page with all those cemetery photos.
Yes, and if you wanted to see Barbara's page for Facebook, you can go to our website, paranormalview.com, and look her up, and all the links will be there. So with that, next week we have on Benjamin Jeffries with his book, Interview with the Boogeyman. So, do join us next week for that. Appreciate everybody dropping by tonight. Hope you had a great time. Until then, this is Henry Foister,
Jeffrey Gould,
and Barbara Duncan.
And we will see everyone next week at the same time. So good night, everybody. You've been listening to The Paranormal View on the Para-X Radio Network. Join us again next week at the same time for more of The Paranormal View.